Either for listeners who are blind, have low vision, or have another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Karen, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the September 27th to 28th 2025 issue of Off Duty from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Okay, our first article is titled Obsessed with Candy. Adults are sinking their teeth into premium confections with serious chew and audible crunch. This is what conspicuous consumption looks like and sounds like in 2025. This has been a big year for me. I turned 50 and I started eating candy. Both were inescapable. Candy, by which I do not mean chocolate, is everywhere. The chewier, crunchier, and more intensely flavored and colored, the better. Candy wants to be seen and heard, and we want to be seen and heard eating it. Social media feeds are flooded by adults loudly chomping on gem-colored, toy-shaped, sugary treats. The content creator known as @jazzy.tingles, a South African expat based in Michigan who prefers not to share her name, developed a passion for candy culture via YouTube. She watched ASMR, Autonomous Sensory Meridian Response videos of YouTubers in different parts of the world eating treats she'd never seen. Chinese candied fruit, Tanghulu, Japanese snowball mochi that look chup sweets made from mung bean paste. Today, her own TikTok reels rack up millions of likes. They feature live tastings, a genre widely known by the Korean name mukbang, of crystal-coated agar-agar jelly or crunchy sour freeze-dried fruit roll-ups. Her videos start with a warning, misophonia alert, eating sounds. Though her legions of followers clearly cannot get enough of the sounds and the visceral sense of candy that they convey. At Jazzy.Tingles has a talent for translating what a candy feels and tastes like for her viewers' vicarious pleasure. The texture is like biting into fruity layers of cheese puffs, and the slightly sour kick is ridiculously addictive, she said via email of those freeze-dried fruit roll-ups. What a shopping trip. Beyond TikTok, you can find confectionery as entertainment in the chic boutiques opening across the country. Leo Schulz co-founded the Swedish candy company Bon Bon, which opened its first shop in 2018 in New York City's Lower East Side. A big part of it was the experience factor, he said. We quickly realized this follows a larger trend of the premiumization of everything. Cold brew, chocolate, matcha, and we hadn't seen that yet for gummies and licorice. 7 years later, we most certainly have. Bon Bon has 6 storefronts throughout New York area and is expanding out of state next year. Candycopia established itself in Oak Park outside Chicago in 2022. Lil Sweet Treat launched in 2024 and already has locations in Manhattan, Philadelphia, and Boston, where just this week the sweetest fish hung out in its shingle after establishing a presence in Cape Cod back in June. Candy, another spot that traffics in Swedish sweets, parked itself in Los Angeles back in February. All aboard Candy dropped anchor in Philly 4 months later, and Scandi Candy touched down in Miami this summer. Whereas the well-known Dylan's Candy Bar chain caters to kids, these spaces invite grown-ups to compose their own candy mixes, a luxury attainable for under $10. I'll offer e-commerce if you're unable to score a popular Bubs Fizzy Foamy Fruity Treat near you. Founded by the Lindstrom family in 1992 and sold to Orkla Confectionery and Snacks in 2023, the Swedish Bubs brand skyrocketed to global fame on TikTok in 2024 and brought their products stateside. The two-toned lemon raspberry skull and banana toffee foam oval have been early favorites in the U.S. Bubs lovers in New York City between now and October 22nd can shop the brand's first stateside pop-up. Feeling all the feels. For some perspective on the antecedents of the conspicuous candy consumption, I turn to Andrea Hernandez, an expert in food products and founder of Snacks Shot, a Substack publication and social media account. Hernandez, a millennial, said her generation is embracing moreness in candy as a reaction to restrictive dietary trends. We grew up in the golden era of snacks, Dunkaroos, Gushers, and then came the demonization of sugar. Gen Zers, Hernandez continued, have spent more of their existence online and evaluate products based on how much attention or influence they might draw. They find anything hypersensory or tactile, especially compelling, jaw-working chewiness, ear-shattering crunchiness, hair-raising sourness, like they want to feel something, Hernandez said. Hernandez has observed a movement away from super sweet to sour spice bitterness. Filipino-American baker and cookbook author Abby Balaguer's sour spicy candy of choice is Mexican Vero Relorindos. Shaped like a tamarind pod, the candy's hard exterior delivers that fruit sour punch and then gives way to the chili-infused caramel center. Balaguer is also a fan of Bon Bon Sour Blackberry Fish. At Jazzy Tingles, Crave's Manhattan milk bottles from South America, the foamy gummies with a subtle flavor that's all about the texture and memories. For cookbook author and product designer Frankie Gaw, Japanese Botan rice candy has been a favorite since childhood. He appreciates the box with its vintage Asian graphic design as much as the not-too-sweet chewy treats themselves. Of another nostalgic choice was Serious Chew, Goss said. If Tootsie Roll had an arch nemesis, it would be the White Rabbit, this little white soft candy that when chewed releases so much saliva and condensed milk flavor, you just can't help but eat more. For Balaguer, childhood returns via gummy assortments. The variety of textures is fun, she said. Some pieces are like chewing on rubber, but I like it. She has a similar soft spot for UK brand Marks and Spencer's adorable elastic Percy Pig gummy candy, which made its U.S. debut at Target in the spring. Schultz of Bon Bon wants to introduce Americans to Lördagsgodis, a Swedish tradition he grew up with. In this weekly Saturday ritual, adults and children alike eat candy together as a family. Now living in Brooklyn, he still enjoys the marshmallow bananas he takes to his father-in-law's house in lieu of wine, the salty lenses, licorice pastilles he and his mother love, and the red Ferrari wine gums of his school days. Candy can offer comfort, Shouts noted. During the COVID pandemic, Bon Bon's business spiked. People seek it out in times of stress, he said. Some of us are stressed, reclaiming sugar as a pleasure that needn't, after all, be guilty among consenting adults. Others are just beginning to explore the wider world beyond Twizzlers, now at our sticky fingertips. For both, candy is meeting the moment. Okay, next we have under style and fashion, the harsh story of lace. Once a costly delicacy crafted by exhausted, exploited women and reserved for elites, lace became a mainstream cliche. Now reinvented, it's resurgent. Until recently, lace was discovered a niche textile, too fussy for the hurly-burly of everyday life. But over the past few seasons, lace has morphed from florid to fabulous, currently enjoying a visibility it hasn't seen since Madonna was in her virgin era. At the Fashion Forward Venice Film Festival a few weeks ago, the airy textile was a persistent theme. Three high-profile women made the case for black lace frocks. Kaia Gerber wore an Audrey Hepburn-esque Valentino. Sofia Coppola chose Marc Jacobs. And Chloe Sevigny layered a 2008 Saint Laurent drop waist bubble tutu over bike shorts. All three made best dress list, even if Sevigny's ensemble recalled Demi Moore's widely panned self-designed 1989 Oscars look, a lacy nightmare that grafted together an 18th century bodice, a cutaway skirt, and spandex shorts. Historically, lace came in two types, named for the tools that produced them. To create needle lace, a single needle and thread were used. To fabricate bobbin lace, multiple threads were unspooled from swindle-shaped bobbins and twisted into intricate patterns. Both methods first appeared in the late 15th century Italy. Initially, only upper-class women had the leisure hours to undertake the time-consuming process. By one estimate, it took about 5 painstaking hours to produce a square centimeter of lace. But as demand increased, the aristocratic hobby evolved into a large-scale business fueled by working-class women and girls who began learning their craft by age 5. Unlike their male peers in the cloth trade, who were members of guilds, these workers were at the mercy of merchants who supplied the materials, collected the finished work, and claimed the bulk of the astronomical profits. Those lovely lace collars, caps, and cuffs that the wealthy wear in 17th and 18th century portraits cost the equivalent of a working man's annual wages, which we can safely assume exceeded those of working women's. But while making lace from dawn until dusk was punishing, it was preferable to spinning the fine threads used in the process, work that was done in a dark, damp basements to protect the gossamer strands from drying out. Lace has such an emotional weight, said designer Olaf Johnson, who continually adds to a lace collection she inherited from her late mother. When I work with it, I feel connected to the chain of women who've made it. The craft of a 300-year-old Portofino workshop that produces lace and linen tablecloths so impressed Johnson that she collaborated with its artisans for her fall collection. Growing up in Ireland, lace was something you encountered in homes and family heirlooms, pieces made with care, passed down through generations, said the New York-based designer Maria McManus. That connection to the craft has stayed with me since I was young. Almost all commercial lace is now made by machine and has been since the 1840s when production was fully mechanized. Industrialization lowered prices drastically, yielding, among other things, the lace curtains so beloved by Victorians. This same era bequeathed us lace twin cliches, white wedding gowns via Victoria herself, and black lingerie, although the latter began as a form of mourning, and not only later took on erotic connotations. As these Odette Odile extremes suggest, lace is inherently contrary, a textile defined by the absence of material. Also changing lace's status, men are reappropriating it. Though they once welcomed the embellishment, beginning in the 1790s, men exchanged it for more sober garb in an about-face known as the Great Masculine Renunciation, partly prompted by the French Revolution. Even as recently as 2014, Marc Jacobs' decision to attend the Met Gala in a black lace shirt dress was considered so bizarre that Seth Meyers parodied the look. 10 years later, Travis Kelce's appearance in a jean jacket covered in what looked like doilies was a non-event. Lace, it seems, is not just everywhere, but for everyone. And you are listening to a reading of articles and features from Off Duty from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Okay, our next article, also under Style and Fashion, Scent of a He-Man. Hairy-chested scents evoking horses, gasoline, and cigarettes occupy an odd niche in men's fragrance. A decidedly unmacho writer hunts for the best. I am as macho as a water lily, more garnish snipper than wood chopper. This extends to my scent choices, which skew light, fresh, even floral. But the other month, while browsing in a AD's perfumery, a cult Manhattan store, I encountered a fragrance redolent of a dirty ashtray. Intriguingly moody, acro smoke made me want to shrug on a leather jacket, I don't own one, and murder a pack of camels, the last puff I took in college, ended in my nearly hurling up a lung. As I spritzed my wrists with a tester, a cool pal complimented me on my Marlboro Man aroma. I considered my newly brooding self. Had I got it wrong all these years? What other insanely smoky, woody, boozy aromas was I missing out on? I resolved to sniff out today's best macho scents, like a bloodhound with a masculinity complex. Over 2 weeks, I sampled more than 20 new and older niche, pricey fragrances recommended by pros for their Popeye flexing a bicep notes. I shoved my wrists under the nostrils of dozens of friends, colleagues, and fashion show seatmates. This elicited many oohs of delight and fewer than 5 looks of disgust. What makes a scent macho? A lack of sweetness and prominent florals is often key, said Sebastian Jara, a content creator known as the Perfume Guy. Synthetic recreations of woods, spices, leather, and experimental notes like gunpowder frequently factor in. These scents are mostly eau de parfum and extrait de parfum, more potent than cologne, which is diluted and needn't be marketed solely at men. We consider all fragrances unisex, said AD's co-founder Robert Gerstner. Lots of the most masculine scents are also worn by women. In 2025, my hunt for traditionally manly scents almost feels quaint. According to Andrew Everett, a perfumer at International Flavors and Fragrances, today's dominant scent trend favors sweet, unisex perfumes, especially gourmand varieties that mimic sugary foods. Jara generally finds that younger folks do not like the uber masculine fragrances. They like sweetness, the more daring, more masculine offerings. He said, come from niche brands. I think you have to have an advanced palate to appreciate them. This poured rocket fuel on my quest. If I fell for these dark, dirty aromas, I could look down my nose at cupcake-scented masses. I started with what I call big, smelly animal scents. New York Fashion Week was on, and I attended a show reeking of a horse. Not any old nag, a fiery and impetuous horse, as per the website for the scent, Corpus Equinus by Naomi Goodsir. A stylish Reuter friend declared it sexy, though my grin straightened when she added that he loves nasty scents. While admittedly a bit hay and stables funky, it also recalled expensive leather. This impetuous thoroughbred was wearing a Hermes saddle. The next day, I sat front row wearing a rhinoceros-themed fragrance from Zoologist, a Canadian brand known for its animalic potions. If this is how a rhino smells, I thought, get me to a savanna. A leathery right hook to the schnoz. The vegan recipe contained notes of tobacco, whiskey, and rum, because rhinos are known for being chain-smoking drunks. My seatmate, a glamour stylist, praised its spiciness and was thrilled it didn't smell citrusy, like so many men's scents. I planned to wear Zoologist T-Rex fragrance to a show, but I couldn't bring myself to subject the glitterati to this beautiful bestial brew, which roared with smoky cade from juniper and metallic rose oxide. Instead, I wore to brunch with my sister, who was delighted. You smell stale, musty, and a bit bloody, she said, as her King of the Dinosaurs bro tore apart a bowl of maple pecan granola. Fragrances marketed as rugged and manly took off in the 1950s and 60s, said Alina Vosnacki, a fragrance historian and author. Before the 20th century, she said, wealthy men wore non-gendered scents. Napoleon supposedly marched into battle smelling of rosemary and lavender, while Louis XV had a thing for orange blossom. Louis XIV. Etat libero d'oranges rain intense incense, which I wore to a co-working space, would have obliterated the Sun King's dainty nostrils. But other subtler, spicy, woody scents came off appealingly retro. My favorite, what Granddad would have liked, scent, 80s Grenadille d'Afrique. It smelled soothing, savory, and deeply woody, like the bottom drawer of an oak cupboard, as my partner put it. According to Antonia Cole, a co-founder of San Francisco store Ministry of Scent, the ongoing trend for smoky scents is pushing new boundaries with notes like cigarette smoke and ash. People have found this repellent probably 20 years ago, said Cole. A bold new release, Fuoco by Jayadid, recalled a restaurant smoking section circa 1975, whereas Acro Smoke, the one that sparked this whole adventure, felt like stepping onto a mildly smoky street. I much prefer its airier take. At Emmanuel, New York, a new boutique, I asked owner Dustin Lujan to bring me the most masculine fragrance. He handed me Elemental Fragrances Velvet Johnson, which he said was inspired by a famous porn star's penis. Rhubarb and bubblegum featured, I didn't dare ask. Lujan also suggested perfumes, Cortina's Aerofanti, which he said was inspired by a motorcycle astronaut on the moon. I didn't question the imagery. What's a Harley doing up there? Because I was busy trying to locate my nose, which had been blown off by the Aerofanti bracing whack of gasoline. But the aroma softened quite nicely. My sister, a fan, likened it to a clean department store. Our new brew beat out the Sigs, Beasts, and Multitasking Spacemen. The Grudge by swashbuckling London brand Beaufort smelled of sea and spice with notes of frankincense, wormwood, seaweed, and musky ambergris, a substance sometimes referred to as sperm whale vomit. While many other scents sweetened over time, the Grudge remained pleasantly savory. The one colleague coughed pointedly when I sprayed it on mid-meeting. It was week two of my quest and my manners had long gone. It generally won rave reviews. One colleague called it expensive smelling. Another swooned. I would date someone wearing that. It could have been the biblical spices, but my money's on the whale discharge. And you are listening to a reading of articles and features from Off Duty from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Okay, our next article under Style and Fashion is titled Coat of Many Dollars, the latest fashion status symbol for the wealthy, a $1,395 reversible customized parka from the British brand Marfa Stance. A few years ago, when Joan King asked her daughter Allie what she wanted for her 40th birthday, there was one thing on Allie's wish list, a pricey coat from a brand King had never heard of. I said, it's a $1,000 coat. Okay, well, it's a significant birthday, recalled King, a retired banker who lives in Manhattan and Newport, Rhode Island. As of this year, King owns 6 of the label's coats and Allie has 10. The brand Marfa Stance makes parkas and jackets that have become cult items among Hamptons moms and Aspen art collectors. Wearers say strangers often stop them on the street to ask, is that a Marfa? Made from dead stock leftover textiles from mills or other brands and recycled materials often resembling quilted military coat liners, every piece is reversible and can be customized with a variety of collars, hoods, and liners. A vest starts at $1,295, a coat at $1,395, but the prices don't deter clients from buying multiples at a time. After establishing itself as the mom coat du jour, the brand is now courting men with its first full unisex line. Georgia Dant, the brand's founder, had her aha moment in Marfa. The rural Texas town Donald Judd turned into an art destination in the 1970s. At the time, Dant worked at Rag and Bone, designing what felt like too many collections a year and traveling nonstop. When you travel, you outwear garment ties, everything together, she said. She wanted to be able to pack less and own less. Dan started sketching. After spending a year developing Marfa Stance, she launched the brand online in 2019. During its first 6 to 12 months, the brand made about £10,000 a month in revenue. Dant is British and based in London. In 2021, when pandemic restrictions started to ease, Dant was on the first flight out to New York to host a pop-up in New York's wealthy Tribeca neighborhood, where she sold $100,000 worth of coats during the first 4 hours. A line ran down the block. Seeing the importance of in-person shopping, Dant began hosting trunk shows. Last year, the brand hosted 214 of them in places like Nantucket, San Francisco, and Seattle. Now U.S. sales make up 70 to 80% of Marfa Stance's total. In 2024, Marfa Stance's revenue increased 40% year over year, the brand said. Customers say they like the distinctive look of the coats and how they transform for different occasions and seasons. You're buying one piece, but you're really getting seven options in that one, said Christine Heller, who hosted the first Marfa Stance trunk show in Aspen, where she bought four coats on the spot. I've worn the vest in the desert of Namibia, a black tie function in New York, and skiing Aspen Mountain, Heller, who works in a client relations at Sotheby's, said. I can speak on behalf of the Aspen community, knowing the brand is very well received there. It fits the lifestyle. The unisex line, called a shared stance, will feature items including a rain parka, an aviator jacket, and a vest. We get so many guys coming in saying, but what about us, said Dant. After thinking about the ways men's shopping habits differ from women's, Dant decided to mostly forego the trunk show motto with a shared stance. Women get inspired and energized by each other, whereas men are much more solo, sort of lone wolves, when it comes to shopping, she said. Bill King, Joan's husband, is eyeing a vest from the new line. A self-described jacket guy, he managed to snag a rare unisex shareable stance coat the brand made 3 years ago. I travel a lot and take it with me because it's easy and covers a range of climates, he said. He shares the interchangeable collars with his wife. Smita Singh plans to buy her husband a coat. She has several Marfa Stance designs herself. Her first was a bronze and olive parachute parka, black on the reverse side, which she pairs with a baby blue shearling collar. It felt very new in the shaping, the styling, but amazingly functional, said Singh, who lives in California and works in international development and philanthropy. The way Georgia cuts the sleeves, you can wear a big sweater or a jacket under it, and it still looks elegant. Singh often gets stopped in the street when she wears pieces from her Marfa Stance collection. People used to ask who made the coats, but these days, more people recognize the brand's signature quilted style. The coats get an enormous number of compliments, and not always from whom you'd expect, she said. I'm a 50-something woman with white streaks in my hair, and I can't tell you how many 20-something young men have stopped me. Okay, next we have under design and decorating, even design pros need to declutter. At 80, architect and designer Juan Montoya is downsizing, cherry-picking projects, and being careful with his cash. In October of 2023, globally renowned architect and interior designer Juan Montoya went on a divesting spree, selling about 80% of his art and furniture at auctions. The breadth of his collections reflected the eclecticism of his personal taste and his designs. 20th century fine art, a neoclassical busts and minimalist pedestals, African stools, and Art Deco armchairs. What triggered the purge? The world around me evolved, said the Colombian-born Montoya, 80. A breakup with his partner precipitated the sale of the beloved Hudson Valley, New York estate they shared, and more recently, the ability to design and conduct business digitally allowed him to close his office in Manhattan. We wondered how Montoya was enjoying his downsized life and whether paring back has left him with any regrets. How did you decide which pieces to let go of? An object is good as long as it serves a purpose. Once that purpose is not there, it's great to move on. I'm a compulsive buyer, and it's more important to me to have cash for the next opportunity than to try to allocate everything into a new space or keep it with the idea that in the future I will use it. Even sentimental objects? Things can have a meaning at one point, but the meaning doesn't perpetuate. You cannot get rid of a person if you love them, but an object you can get rid of, and it's okay. Property can hold you up. Getting rid of things is a way of regenerating, feeling new, feeling younger. Now that you've closed your office, how do you work? Clients don't want to come to an office anymore. I used to set out plans and we'd go over every detail, but now they want to meet at a restaurant or cafe or their place. I go through my iPad with the items that I have. I do my drawings on the iPad. I do the changes on the iPad, and they're so happy. What about the back office work? I used to have a full-time secretary and two assistants. Now I have satellite people that work for me by the hour, one in the Philippines, one in India, one in Mexico. I used to pay a big accounting firm about $2,000 a month if I did work or didn't work. Now at the end of the year, if they have spent 3 hours, I pay for 3 hours. What if clients do want to meet in an office? That's very rare, but we meet at my apartment in New York. It's modest, 1,200 square feet, but it's well appointed, so I feel proud of it, and I'm saving a bunch of money. Have you cut back on your client load? I am only taking projects that I absolutely want to do with people I really like. I don't want to need to have the client that is a nightmare but pays very well just so I can pay the rent, and I'm not going to be happy. Other things are important to my life right now. And you've bought a country house in Colombia? I fell in love with an 18th century house in Barranquilla, about 7 hours by car from Bogota in the mountains. I'm trying to be smart and bring my money where it should be, make some small income, but still be comfortable and able to travel. Yes, I have some savings, but it's not endless. In Manhattan, I used to take a taxi from my office to my home, and it was about $20. Today, it's $40. Have you family near your new house? My sister and nephews in Bogota are dying to come, and I'm getting more friends. Everybody is warm and nice and uncomplicated. We are not talking about the Hamptons. You can call people and say, let's meet for drinks, let's meet for coffee, and everybody is available, which is so unusual. Do you have any downsizing regrets? I sold my 1994 Land Rover Defender, which has become a status piece. It had height requirements that New York garages couldn't accommodate. It was a fascinating piece of machinery, and my father had a Land Rover in the 1950s. I remember it was not a very fast car, but it was a very strong car. I loved the construction of it. It would be great in Colombia, but bringing things to South America at this stage is pretty expensive. And you're listening to a reading of articles and features from Off Duty from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Next, under Adventure and Travel, we have Mimicry on the Orient Express. Several luxury experiences use the storied train's name. We untangle the differences between them. The thrill of overnighting on a luxury sleeper train has captured imagination since Agatha Christie staged a whodunit aboard the Orient Express in 1934. The real Orient Express, on which Christie frequently traveled, was less murdery than the one in her novel, but just as elegant. Starting in 1883, it ferried starlets, spies, and dignitaries across Europe, the champagne flowing as freely as the gossip. Its route connected Istanbul and Paris with stops in cities like Munich, Vienna, and Budapest. Eventually, the train lost steam and Europe's elite turned to air travel, and the Orient Express, OE line, was discontinued in 1977. That same year, American entrepreneur James Sherwood, a multimillionaire by 36, began a five-year, $31 million mission to revive the rail line by buying two vintage OE carriages at auction. The rechristened Venice Cimpion Orient Express, VSOE, was back on track in 1982 as a founding venture of Orient Express Hotels Limited, better known now as Belmond. The firm deliberately kept the train's name, a direct nod to its gilded predecessor. But Belmond isn't the only company aiming to revive the Orient Express legacy. This year, Accor Group introduced a La Dolce Vita Orient Express, not to be confused with Belmond's Easter and Oriental Express in Southeast Asia. It can all be hard to decipher as the 1930s Gare de l'Est timetable. Here, a primer on the major trains that use the storied names. Almost the real thing. When people picture a luxury sleeper train, they likely think of VSOE, guests in sequins and tuxes tucked into velvet banquettes, sipping bottomless Veuve Clicquot while a pianist plays. Plying part of the original OE route, the VSOE features 18 original cars from the 1920s, but Belmond has taken some liberties, said Mark Smith, who runs the train travel site, the man in seat 61. While the VSOE's two-berth compartments are largely authentic, the new grand suites with 24-hour butler service are not. Itineraries range from one night hops in entry-level cabins, around $4,700, to the entire five-night trip between Paris and Istanbul in a grand suite, around $85,000. Smith treasures the VSOE's connection to the past. I accidentally became engaged on it back in 2003, he said. Powerful magic, that train. Belmond also runs the Eastern and Oriental Express, another result of multimillionaire James Sherwood's zeal in the high-class tradition of VSOE, but that train travels the length of Malaysia, starting in Singapore. COVID shut the luxury line down for 4 years, but LVMH, Moët Hennessy, Louis Vuitton, Belmond's owner since 2019, gave it a new life in 2024 with refreshed cabins and new routes. Roman Holiday. In April, things took a curious turn when La Dolce Vita Orient Express debuted in Rome as the first Italian-made luxury sleeper train. Part of the Accor Group, it's marketed as luxury cruise on rails. Prices run from about $3,500 to around $16,500, depending on route and room class. Itineraries include the one-night taste of Tuscan vineyards centered on Brunello wines in Montalcino, and a 3-day jaunt in Rome into Sicily with onboard meals by Michelin-starred chef Heinz Beck. To enter Sicily, the entire train is ferried across the Strait of Messina in a nifty feat of engineering. While Benmont has licensed the Orient Express name for its train, Accor owns the actual trademark, having acquired the name from SNCF, France's National Railway Company, in 2017. Not everyone is convinced. It's hard to see what the Dolce Vita has to do with the Orient Express, said Smith. Like Titanic with the Orient Express, myth has overtaken reality. The Dolce Vita's interpretation conjures 1960s Italy with restored Italian Z1 carriages and interior design by Milanese firm Demore Studio, featuring brass details so polished riders can fix their makeup in the reflection. In 2026, Accor will unveil the Orient Express Corinthian, which is notably not a train at all but a sailing yacht. The first of two such Accor ventures, it will include an Agatha Christie suite. Thankfully, there is hope for a little more clarity. In June 2024, LVMH said it would make a strategic investment in Accor's Orient Express brand. Announcing the deal, the company said they would work in tandem to carry the name wherever it goes next, by rail, sea, or otherwise. Okay, our next article, under eating and drinking, great taste, no headache. In the past, Americans have not sought out light beers for their flavor. Now brewers, big and small, are bringing real craft to their lower alcohol lagers, pilsners, and even IPAs. Day drinking requires careful appraisal of time and alcohol intake. Start too early and heavy and you'll be asleep by sunset. One recent Sunday afternoon, I tried a promising strategy. While watching football, I crushed a couple cans of Saranac Brewery Weekend Warrior, a cracker crisp pilsner with a wee 3% ABV. As I rooted for a Cincinnati Bengal win, the pilsners refreshed and let me bypass the nap that IPAs twice as strong necessitate. I really like drinking beer, but I don't always want a beer that's more than 6% ABV, said Fred Matt, president of Saranac Parenting Company, FX Matt Brewing in Utica, New York. Throughout the 2010s, craft breweries rarely trimmed a beer's alcohol content. They built their fan bases by way of dizzyingly strong imperial stouts and double IPAs. But as craft beer's core business customers age, many breweries are betting on mid-strength beers. They're around 3% ABV or lower, less boozy yet more flavorful than light lagers, typically about 4% ABV, a category to take seriously. Not too intoxicating beers are staples in the UK, Scandinavia, and Australia, where higher taxes on stronger beers incentivize breweries to provide options with less alcohol. American brewers, which are taxed on volume, not alcohol content, have long pushed the boundaries of their beer's booziness. In the Samuel Adams beer Utopias, for example, barrel aging as well as a whopping 28% ABV invite comparisons to spirits such as cognac. Many American craft brewers blew off that lower ABV segment, said Jared Williamson, head brewer at Schlafly in St. Louis. After exploring the heights of alcohol content, Williamson is keen to navigate the shallows, perhaps craft beer's final frontier. His low alcohol shorty lines in include a 3% ABV small IPA, a popular lunchtime option at Schlafly's tap rooms. You're still consuming alcohol, but it's not that intoxicating, he said. The target consumer for the mid-strength beers looks a lot like middle-aged me. I spent my 20s and early 30s downing double IPAs, but now 8% ABV beers make it tough to wake up at 6 a.m. to help get my daughter to middle school. You're pretty done with being able to tackle heavy nights of drinking, said Ryan Kutchner, 46, who has a 2-year-old child. To minimize alcohol intake but still get some flavor, he started mixing NA beers with standard craft beers. He went on to co-found Dad Strength Brewing, which focuses on mid-strength beers below 3% ABV, including the Fruity Juicy IPA. According to Kutchner, during tastings, customers will, unprovoked, rattle off ideal occasions for drinking a Dad Strength brew. Softball games, mowing the lawn, hitting the beach. Kutchner said the beers sell well in the suburbs. That's Dad's natural habitat. What you're getting for your money, mid-strength beers cost no less to produce than higher ABV ones. At Lumen Beer in Omaha, Nebraska, owner Dan Brulette uses the same amount of hops in Puff, a 3.2 ABV IPA, as one that's double that strength. We didn't cut any corners, Brulette said. Hops and yeast are his biggest expenses. Small Beer sells its 2.5% ABV lager for around $12 per six-pack of 12-ounce cans, about the same price you might pay for stronger pale ales and IPAs. We will never win on dollars for buzz, said Jez Thomas, a co-founder of Austin, Texas company. He often faces initial skepticism for that reason, but Small Beer offers a different, increasingly compelling value proposition. Drinkers can hit happy hour or a work dinner and enjoy the same amount of beers while also cutting back on alcohol, Thomas said. Indeed, low alcohol can be a savvy sales pitch. When Eric Kobus, the general manager for the Chicago area beer distributor Glunz Imports, first sold Austria's Stiegel Grapefruit Radler, a lager grapefruit soda blend, he encouraged his accounts to mix the 2% ABV beer with tequila or vodka to make a more potently alcohol drink. Now he finds he doesn't need to. We can proudly say we're 2%. And lastly, we have a short article under Cult Following. It was meant to beam. A satellite dish? A parabolic telescope? No, it's the Tachia table lamp, an icon of design. In 1962, Milanese brothers Archil and Pier Guacanimo Castellani created their room-spanning arco floor lamp. That same year, the industrial design duo found another way to rethink ceiling fixtures, turning them upside down. The Tachia lamp indeed inverts bulb and shade. Its aluminum base, fluted like a Doric column, originally hid an incandescent bulb and was designed to prevent overheating. We certainly did not have prestige in mind when we designed it. We just wanted to create a cooling surface, reflected Archil in a 1970 interview. Today, LED lights obviate the need, though the radiator-like design remains. Allure. The piece, a sculptural 25 inches tall, nods to the space race and hints at postmodernism to come, says Los Angeles interior designer Oliver Firth. I especially like that it's modular, he added. The blown glass diffuser rests on the base, unattached like a crystal ball on the collar. You can easily swivel and slant it to direct the lamp's mesmeric reflected glow. Fans. Nicholas Whiskery, artistic director of Louis Vuitton Wayne's Collections, used a pair to frame a ladyfinger-like sofa by Pierre Poulin in his Paris apartment. Cult moment. In the Star Trek series Strange New Worlds, the lamp cameos in a holodeck recreation of a 1960s Hollywood mansion. Off-screen, the Takia sits in the permanent collection of the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. And you've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the September 27th to 28th, 2025 issue of Off Duty from the Wall Street Journal. We read from Off Duty every Saturday at 6 p.m. Your reader has been Karen, and thank you very much for listening. And take care of yourself and have a good day. Bye-bye.
Coming up next to the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, we have Harper's Magazine at 8 o'clock. We have Sports Illustrated at 9 o'clock. We have The Athletic, a section of the New York Times. Stay with us for these readings and more through the rest of the evening. Are you facing challenges with vision loss and need help with your smartphone, sending emails, navigating the internet, and staying connected with your family? VIA, Visually Impaired Advancement, is offering free classes for seniors weekly at multiple locations with free assistance for your smartphone, email, and internet skills. There's a new session every week, and it rotates between the South Towns and the North Towns. It's at your local Erie County Libraries, and at 10 a.m. and 11:30 a.m. For more information, call Elhana Porter at 716-888-4632. Again, that's 716-888-4632.
Thank you.
The following program is intended for listeners who are blind, have low vision,